actually didn't, I had no design to get into film. My father is a film editor, and at 17 I was living with him and his second wife.
Oh, jeez.
They wanted the teenager out of the house, so he got me a job on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and promptly said, now you can move out. So I cursed him for many years, because it can be a very thankless job at times, you know, the overtime, the egos that will tell you what to do, what not to do, and really they could care less what you might have going on, you know. It's like, but I had tickets to a concert. We don't care, we'll get somebody else to do the job. But I learned very well from my dad's assistant, Todd Ramsey, trained me. He went on to cut Star Trek, the first Star Trek feature, which I went on with him as an apprentice. And then he went with John Carpenter. He cut The Thing and Escape from New York. So I learned very well from him early on. He kind of drilled the business into me on how to do, you know, how to do the job, how to do it right. One of the first things that he kind of pounded into my head was, he said, I can teach a monkey to do your job. What you get paid for is the politics. And so it's something that I took with a grain of salt, but over the years I've realized that it really is a very important aspect of the job. It's many people can do the work and have the talent. It's the people that can deal with the politics that will survive and continue to go forward and can actually make a career out of it. It's nice to have altruistic goals, but there are some people that just don't want to hear it from you, and usually those people are the ones paying your check, so it's just kind of keeping your head down, doing the right job, trying to connect with the good people as you continue in a career, and hopefully, you know, continuing to work with them. It's a lot of the crazy people you learn the most from, because you learn how to survive, but it's really kind of a lot more gratifying when you get to work with somebody who appreciates your work and lets you contribute. So it's just kind of doing the job until you get an association that will appreciate you.
That's definitely a unique story there of how you got into film. So we have kind of gone over your resume via IMDb, and one of the questions that I personally had for you was, you've worked on a lot of different types of projects, from TV to film to animation editing, and how has that defined you as an editor? Do you feel like you're stuck in one genre, or because you have a lot of different experiences, you've been able to pretty much be flexible and do what you want?
You hit it right on the head there. Even as an assistant, I had worked in a lot of different situations, from features to television, movie of the weeks, episodic. I worked a couple post-production department jobs. I worked sound effects and music. So it really helped me a lot, knowing all of the other, because you interact so much with so many other people, departments. Even in just the picture editing, you know, as an assistant, I would have to deliver elements to sound editors, music editors, and it always helped having been in that position to know what they need, to be able to anticipate what they might need when the changes come up. Too often, people are reactive because so many things are happening, and it happens very fast. You're really just trying to keep up with what's going on. But luckily, I had enough exposure to the other fields that I could anticipate and really help my coworkers on any given project. Knowing that they're going to need to know this information now, even though it's not completely defined as far as a change note or whatnot, I can say just to myself, I would sometimes call the sound editor and give them a heads up. And that, many people appreciated that. Going forward into animation, I think that's really, as an editor, I think it's given me a much broader base to work from and bring that kind of experience into this realm where a lot of the people that move up to being editor in animation don't have the kind of experience that I do as far as having dealt with coverage or lack thereof, knowing what really happens, physically with a camera on set. In animation, we do a lot of previs, which is layout, is what they call it here. But I'm very active with the department that we would normally call camera. They're just trying to build the shots here. I'll go into more detail on that as we go into animation, but having that experience in live action really has helped coming through to here to know what else is available, what else I'd like to have, and know how to articulate that.
That's cool.
I you were talking a little bit about animation. And I was just curious on how that workflow runs, especially as an editor for animation. You were just talking about you're kind of involved in trying to, and I know with animation they really are meticulous about doing storyboards, having the shots, already predetermined before they do rendering or do any hand drawings. How does that affect you as an editor? How does that workflow work with you?
Process and it tends to loop back in on itself in many different stages. So it's really, we have many different balls in the air at any given point. The general process starts, with the script, obviously. But even at that, sometimes the story artist will basically just take a concept and start to draw out any given sequence based on that concept. Going back to the Walt Disney era, they did very well by just taking a known project, basically a fairy tale that is already a franchise, so to speak, in that everybody knew the characters and liked the general story, but he basically give that structure to the artist and say, here, make something fun out of the ball with Cinderella or Snow White, come up with a song and then just have something fun. They were pretty much the structure of the story was defined, but the specifics they were allowed to explore and have fun with, and that's kind of what continues today, even based on having an initial script to work from. Unlike live action, where you shoot the script, and then you go back to editorial and you figure out what you have based on the coverage or the performances, here we can cut together the story artist will embellish as they go forward, trying to add jokes here and there. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. We start to cut the storyboards together just from those still drawings and scratch dialogue, which is just temporary. We usually just find somebody that sounds like the character that we ultimately want to have in the film. we don't go pay for actors generally to do these temporary voices, but we'll cut those together with the storyboards, put sound effects, music, and you can build a sequence that you can get a good sense of how it's playing, how the character arcs are working. You can get a good sense of action, comedy, drama, everything out of just the storyboards themselves. And you try and do the whole film that way. Generally, productions kind of push so that you end up having to put certain sequences into animation before you've finished really locking down your storyboard reel, which is problematic because you end up finding, generally what happens is you find that your ending needs to be changed, and by the time you're defining what that ending is, they're already animating the beginning of the film, and so once you find your big climax, you realize that you have to adjust stuff that's already been animated. It's kind of like going back and reshooting the ending on a live-action film, but it's still, I'm probably getting ahead of myself on that one. What's nice about animation is that you can actually basically project your script. You can test it and see what's working and what's not, and continue to rewrite and refine it as you go. The problem is that after 2 to 4 years of it, people can start to get tired of things that actually work. So it's you constantly have to remind, as an editor, you have to remind the director, the producers, that if they're getting tired of something, you have to remind them what their response was the first time they saw it, and say, don't forget, you know, this is what an audience is going to see the first time, and try not to second guess your own concepts.
Hey, Bryce?
Yeah.
This is Seth. I'm over here in the office with Darren. I just waved at the phone, by the way. bear with me. I wanted to cut in really fast and ask Darren a question over here. Darren, sorry, I'm shouting over here because everyone over there needs to hear. I'm over here. I'm a little further away from the phone. But Darren, I noticed that on your IMDb page, you have a credit on The Last Dragon. That is one of my favorite movies ever.
Oh boy!
And I'm curious to know how did I don't remember if it was. I will not say what it was, an assistant credit.
Yeah.
Okay. How has your life been made awesome by working on that movie?
Well, the film is probably mostly forgettable on my part. Unfortunately, I know everybody has one that you grew up with. It's like for me, it was Blazing Saddles. When I finally got to work with Mel Brooks, I could quote every line from that film, and he would just look at me like, how do you remember that stuff? And so I know it's part of when you grew up and the timing that hit just right. For me, the biggest memory of that film was actually the cutting room was located, Tony Bill, directed The Natural, or I can't remember, but he had a building a block away from the beach in Venice, and so we were renting rooms in that building to cut the film, and it was 1984, and the Summer Olympics were in Los Angeles that year, and so I remember taking a break and going and standing on the roof of the building and watching the marathon go past. On the street, and that summer was just amazing. That a block away from the beach at Venice, and literally a block away from the pavilion, which is where you see all the classic skaters, you know, skating the cones, and the girls in thong bikinis, and I mean, and Muscle Beach is just the other side of the pavilion there too. Just the people watching there was crazy, and we'd go down and have lunch on the beach there every day. Just because it was right there, it was quite an experience. On the production side, Barry Gordy was a trip. He'd come in and he had his two guys in black suits. suits, you know, like Blues Brothers looking black suits and black glasses on, and he'd be wearing his white velvet Fila jumpsuit.
Wow.
You know, actually there were sweats because he'd sit on the stool looking at the moviola and his butt crack would be hanging out over the sweats. But he was a cool guy. But his favorite thing is he's always talking about, I just love them kids. You know, and he'd talk about the kids and how the kids would respond. And I guess it worked because... it seems to be there's a good generation of people that really enjoyed that film. I assisted David Rawlins, who was the second editor. My father was the first editor on the film, and he had brought in a second editor, and David had actually worked with a friend of mine who recommended me to him, so it was just kind of by chance that I ended up on that film. But David was actually one of the greatest mentors and experiences for me as an assistant to watch him. He cut Urban Cowboy, China Syndrome, Saturday Night Fever. He cut on the Kung Fu series and actually directed a couple episodes. He's been around forever. He's an old cowboy, really cantankerous. But I learned a lot working with him, and part of his deal was, you know, he taught me once. I cut something together for him, and he said, "Why'd you do that cut?" I said, "Well, you know, the guy's turning around, and whatever he was holding was in a different hand when he turned around, so I cut on the turn just to kind of hide that. And he's like, you know, what did he say? That's editing 101. Said, "What are you looking at in this scene?" I said, "Well, you know, really everything's on his face." He said, "And you're cutting away from his face on the turn. So the audience, if they're staring at his hand, they're not involved in your movie anyways. So stay with his face and just go with the emotional content of the shot when you cut." And this was another good lesson, was that if you paint yourself into a corner and you can't solve something, step away from it for a while. Either literally just step away from whatever Avid or Final Cut, whatever program you're on, or just move on to another scene or continue going forward. I find that I do that even with animation. If something isn't feeling right, I'll try to work it for about 5 minutes, and then I'll just keep going. Get to the end of the scene, and then go back and look at it again from the beginning, and go, "Yep, it's still not working for me." Sometimes, from that oversight, that point of being able to stand back and look at the whole scene, sometimes things will present themselves. It becomes a little more obvious what's wrong or what a solution might be, and sometimes it's just standing back a day or two, and you know, I've worked problematic areas to a point where I think they're okay, and then the next day I look at it again, and it's like, nope, it's still wrong, it's still broken. And half the time, Sherry Galloway, who's my assistant on this show, she worked with me on The Iron Giant. She was a great set of fresh eyes, and she'd look at something and make a comment that kind of looked past whatever I was having trouble with. So it's always good to ask a second opinion, and especially a fresh opinion. You don't have to always take it, but it's good to have a fresh set of eyes just to give you that clean point of view.
Well, you said you worked with Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Was that on Robin Hood?
Robin Hood and also Life Stinks.
Yeah.
David Rawlins was the editor on Life Stinks.
I have to ask you about Steve Rifkin then.
Yeah.
Because my internship was on Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, yeah.
And do you have any dirt on Steve that I can email back to him? And
Steve is my other mentor. I don't know if it's dirt per se on Steve, but I got him the job on Robinhood. Having worked on Life Stinks with Mel, I got a call from Mel's assistant, Leah Zappi. She's been with him, actually she's just actually moving on this year, but she'd been with him for about 15 years doing all the post for him. And after Life Stinks, as the assistant, I delivered all of the final elements and cataloged and had provided it so cleanly for her, because there's always a lot of laboratory work that happens afterwards. She basically insisted that Mel hire me again as an assistant, and I got this call from Mel saying, you know, we're doing this Robin Hood movie, and I want you to work on this film. And I'm like, okay. It starts in February, and at the time, you know, that was like a couple months away. I said, well, I can wait if you say so. And Mel was like, who are you talking to? Well, Mel Brooks. Well, I say it's starting. I said, okay, well, I'll be there when it starts. And then he turned around and said, so who would you recommend as editor? Which was a strange situation for me as the assistant, and I knew better than to push myself forward because I didn't have the credits.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, David Rollins, who was the editor I'd worked with. And he said, well, if David wasn't available, who would you recommend? And so I knew basically what was going on there. And here's where, you know, you get paid for the politics comes in. I knew that basically he just did not want to hire David again, but his assistant wanted me back, so he started with me and asked. And I had worked with Steven on two films, actually, on Graffiti Bridge, which was a crew of five editors, and then Steven had brought me on a little film called Run. Patrick Dempsey, actually. He was the second editor on that, and so I assisted him. And I knew that Steven was easygoing, very determined, and just, you know, talented enough to work with Mel. And so I put his name forward, and Mel was like, well, are you sure? I said, you know, yeah, I'm sure that you'd like him, Mel. And said, besides, he's Jewish.
Yeah.
Because Mel had come in one day on Life Stinks, and he looked around, and he said, look at this, I got a bunch of goys working on my film. but I recommended Steve, and the producer called me back later, and, you know, said, you know, and so what are his other credits? And, you know, I gave him all the references and stuff, and he hired Steve, and it worked out so well that Mel recommended him to Norman Jewison on Only You. Was a film I went on location with, but my ex-wife didn't want me to go to Canada for post, so I didn't end up finishing that film with Steven. But he was great to work with. It's one of the things I learned from him is that even if you know something, if you know in your heart something isn't right and the director's asking you to do it, just try it. And there's a way to come back. I've had this happen a few times where the director has told me, no, just do it this way, and that bone inside of you just kind of twists sideways, and you go, no, oh, that's going to be horrible. You know it won't work, and you put it in, and sure enough, it doesn't work, but they love it. And so how do you deal with that? And actually, you find a way to say, but there's still something something about this and you find the core of why. Don't say why it's wrong, but say something is not connecting for you, or you know, there's a gracious way of saying that this cut for some reason is not working, instead of saying, well, you've crossed the line or whatever, you know, because you can get away with crossing the line in many places, you know, just because it's a film law, it doesn't mean it can't be broken. But I've found that by presenting it back as, well, there's still just something, not working, and sometimes I've had to wait a day or two to bring it back up and say, are you sure? Because there's still something here, and I've found that by giving a reason or just an emotional aspect of why this isn't working for me, the director will come back and say, well, then just put this one over on the other side, and it fixes my problem, and it still keeps their concept. I find that generally, even though I know something isn't going to work, there usually is a way to fix it so that it still works for both people.
Do you ever mentor students or interns yourself?
As I can, I do. When I was at Pixar, there was an intern that came up from AFI, and I try and offer, just, you know, if my door is open, just come on in. Unless the director's in, please just come by and hang out. You're always welcome to. Sometimes there's some sensitive material that I'm working with that may not allow somebody to sit in, but generally, we had a PA on Ratatouille that, he was eager and said, do you mind if I come in and just sit over your shoulder? And that's, I always welcome that kind of stuff, because that's the best way to learn. When I was a film assistant, you had to be in the room because you were pulling the clips, you were listening to the conversation, and I learned so much just by being a fly on the wall to that dialogue, the back and forth between the editor and the director, and being an active participant in that they would be exploring or trying to find a solution to something, and I might come up with an idea, and usually I'd keep my mouth shut because I knew better, but after a couple years of thinking these answers through and having that thought be confirmed by what the director or editor finally did, I got up enough confidence to eventually, you know, I'd always try and think that solution all the way through, because the first couple times I opened my mouth, that's great, but the wardrobe has changed, so that won't work, you know, kind of stuff. So I always tried to think everything through, but being in that room, I was able to really kind of practice that for many years. The best part of film was that I actually would be pulling clips, you know, if they were looking for something, and over the shoulder, and I would remember a take where they actually turned and we could cheat something or whatnot. I was able to say, what about this, you know, the shot where they turned, and they go, oh yeah, that would be great. These days with the computers, you don't have that kind of active participation in the room with the director and editor, so it's much harder to get that experience. All I can provide is my experience, you know, on a solo level, but I can also give a little more insight too on as to how directors can respond or whatnot. And I love having somebody that's eager to learn and actually willing to sit in and ask questions. It's a little different here because you have to actually be in the company. I mean, these guys are lucky. lucky to be here, and I said the room is open here. But as far as being able to mentor beyond people in the company, I know it gets sensitive because there is material here that they don't like, you know, people to know about because it's 3 years out sometimes, and they want to be very careful about who knows the story and the details of those things.
I have a question about, this is Bryce again, how has editing 3D versus 2D affected you? And I guess an extension of that question would be, like, you worked with Brad Barber on Iron Giant and then again on Ratatouille. Did that workflow change at all because of the nature of the animation, or is it pretty similar?
It actually has changed to the better, I think, going from 2D to 3D, and you have to be careful these days when you say 3D because there's now the stereoscopic aspect, you know, where you wear the 3D glasses, but I'm assuming you're talking about going from traditional hand-drawn animation to CG.
Yes, that's what I meant.
It's very beneficial having come from the traditional side and knowing a lot of the longer term aspects of the pipeline and how many people have to actually be up to speed with something before you can work with it. But the great advantage now is that before with traditional animation, when you went to layout, it was just a concept, and you had to really be confident in your cutting pattern because you didn't get to see it until it was animated, and at that point, it's very costly to change the cut point. With CG, we can go from, and here we'll start to do the process. I'll give you a little more background. When we finish storyboard on any given sequence, going into production, then it will go to the layout department, and sometimes it's called previs, but it's basically the same thing, where they will build a 3D model of the set and start to put a virtual camera in that set, building what you would call stand-ins of your actors, of your characters, basically placing them in the room, and if you've got a shot where there's two people standing talking together and then one turns to exit, they will block out that action, and almost as if you were on a live action set with stand-ins, you'd be blocking your camera work. And they'll actually shoot that and deliver it to us in editorial, so we'll get a very rough version just so that you can test the camera, the cutting pattern. It's getting a lot more elaborate these days, where the actual blocking of the character is starting to be done on a much deeper level. Usually the animators would throw out the blocking completely and start over, which could create problems with your camera. With animation, you really have to kind of lock down what that camera is going to see, because that determines how much of the set they're going to build or animate. You know, if you're outside, that tells them how much grass they actually have to try and move, if there's wind, or how much cloud they're going to see in the background. Every element of a shot is drawn or created by somebody, and so the more you see, the more it costs. So they're always constantly trying to get you to simplify and stay in your two shots, or, you know, tighter shots. So it's always a kind of tug of war between creative and production as to how complicated you can make a shot, and it's constantly going back and forth. With CG now, you can actually build those shots, and kind of like with coverage and live action, you can cut it together. They ask you to basically lock your cut. That's the only problem, because then once the animators with production starts to go through and, you know, everything, every aspect, cloth, hair, every element of your character is given to a different department to work on, and there's many man hours for any given frame of film, it seems. So it's a little more complicated. You're constantly being asked to keep an eye on all of those aspects and still try and create something that's cinematic and tells a good story. So it's more of a film by committee than anywhere else. But luckily it's generally a very democratic process, and you have a lot of nice people. You don't have as many of those toxic egos, you know, like Michael Bay, who will just make you work until 3 in the morning just because he wants something. It's since everybody has to work together on such a large level, the tyrants generally get pushed out. So that's why I like animation myself. Plus, as an editor, you're involved so early. I'm actually involved in the script process to a good degree. You can move elements of the story around where you're not tied to locations or, you know, time of day or wardrobe. You can actually move whole scenes around at an early stage, and because you're just doing it in storyboards, you can do it fairly cheaply, and you can accomplish a lot. Like I said, you really get to project your script, and you can continue to refine that script for a couple of years.
We really appreciate you taking time out of your day and doing this for us, and we are gonna post this recording on our blog if that's all right with you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm honored.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you later. Thanks.
Yes. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Seth.
Yeah. Bye.